Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
Be seated. This morning, the court has two cases set for oral argument. The first case is U.S. Bank National Association versus South Dakota Department of Revenue. Justice Devaney has disqualified herself, and so retired Justice Glenn Severson has been appointed to sit with the court on this case. He's appearing remotely this morning by both video audio feed. Justice Severson, can you hear us okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Sounds good.
Good.
All right. Thank you. Appearing on behalf of U.S. National Bank, Craig Fields is arguing for the appellant. And appearing for the Department of Revenue, John Richter is arguing on behalf of the department. Both sides will have initially 20 minutes to argue. The U.S. Bank as appellate will have an opportunity for a 10-minute rebuttal. When the yellow light comes on, that's your two-minute warning that you have 2 minutes left in your argument. So with that, Mr. Fields, you may proceed with oral argument at this time.
May it please the court. This case involves whether U.S. Bank is entitled to the deduction contained in Section 10-43-10.3, Subdivision 3, currently Subdivision 2, but for the years in issue, Subdivision 3, for taxes imposed upon the financial institution under the Internal Revenue Code, and if so, the methodology for computing that. The case is really an issue of statutory interpretation. What is the meaning of the term, quote, taxes imposed on the financial institution under the Internal Revenue Code, close quote. We believe the Internal Revenue Code answers that question. Section 11 of the Internal Revenue Code is entitled Tax Imposed, and it says tax is imposed for each taxable year on the taxable income of every corporation. Thus, under Section 11, the tax is imposed on taxable income. When a corporation computes its tax return, line 30 is entitled taxable income. The corporation reports its taxable income on there. In calculating its federal tax deduction, U.S. Bank started with its federal taxable income, separate federal taxable income, and multiplied it by the tax rate, which during these years was 35%, to arrive at the federal tax deduction. This, for example, for 2012, U.S. Bank started with its line 30 taxable income on its pro forma return, which was approximately $4.9 billion. And this is the same amount on the entity detail that is part of the consolidated returns, line 30 for U.S. Bank, the $4.9 billion. And this is the same amount that U.S. Bank used to start in the computation of its bank franchise tax here in South Dakota, the $4.9 billion. Which the department did not contest. They agreed that that was the correct number. U.S. Bank then took the $4.9 billion and multiplied it by the 35% tax rate to determine its federal tax deduction. And that came to approximately $1.7 billion for the 2012 year. And we submit that under a plain reading of the statutes of the federal tax deduction and Internal Revenue Code Section 11, that is the proper way to compute the federal tax deduction, taxable income, times the tax rate.
So if you construe, good morning, Mr. Fields, by the way.
Excuse me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
When you construe or when you interpret or propose the interpretation for taxes imposed, is your argument then that the imposed part is susceptible to a plain and an ordinary reading, imposed meaning what, applied from sounds of it in your brief?
That is correct, Your Honor. I believe under your Citibank case, when its statute is plain, unambiguous, and clear, you apply the statute as written. And here, the statute at issue, the federal tax deduction in the South Dakota Code, talks about tax imposed under the Internal Revenue Code. And Internal Revenue Code says tax imposed, and tax is imposed on federal taxable income.
The circuit court judge, thank you. The circuit court judge and the administrative decision makers, to varying degrees, seem to think that there's also a component to the verb imposed that is in the nature of a compulsory obligation, maybe one imposed by the law, such as a legal obligation to pay taxes. Why, in your view, is that definition one that we can overlook and en route to accepting your argument?
Well, I don't think you have to overlook it, Your Honor. I think it is the tax imposed by the Internal Revenue Code. It is what the company is obligated to pay under the Internal Revenue Code to the federal government.
But you're really not obligated to pay that entire amount, of course. And then we have the question of, in your view, satisfying the amount of the total taxes that you would say are imposed. And I guess what I'm driving at is it possible that the taxes are both imposed under the way you sort of have analyzed the issue, which is your income multiplied by 35%, and also the taxes are imposed when you arrive at the total tax after applying the credits to which you're entitled, that tax is imposed as well. Is it possible that it's imposed in both instances?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think the tax is imposed under the statute, under the Internal Revenue Code, on the taxable income. That amount is paid through both cash payments and through credits. You know, credit does not exempt something from tax.
I need to interrupt you. If I could, please, though. Thank you. In your brief, you have a statement. It's in the top. It's in the principal brief and the reply brief, and it's a quote. And it says exactly, I think, where you might be headed, which is tax credits spend just like cash, and I'm paraphrasing. And it cites a portion of the record. That's testimony from Mr. Scribner. Is there authority in a case or a statute or a rule or something like that that says precisely that? A tax credit is like cash. And I understand that credits are different than deductions. It's a dollar for dollar reduction. I get all that. But is there something that says what Mr. Scribner said that can be sourced to some sort of authority?
I'm not aware of a case that says either that or the opposite, Your Honor.
Okay, thank
you. I believe this is a case of first impression.
Counsel, how would you distinguish the cases that out of these tax courts, Norwest and Sparrow?
Well, actually, Your Honor, I wouldn't distinguish them at all. I think they support us. I'm surprised that the department and the circuit court cited to them and relied on them. I don't think they support the department's position. I think they support U.S. Bank's position. The Norwest case, the issue was computing the minimum tax liability. For federal purposes, you compute a regular tax liability, and then there's also an alternative minimum tax. And if the minimum tax is higher, you pay the minimum tax. And in Norwest, the companies filed a consolidated federal return and computed their regular tax on a consolidated basis. In computing the alternative minimum tax basis, they argued that they should be allowed to compute it on a separate return basis and add them up. And what the court held, no, since you computed the regular tax liability on a consolidated basis, you must compute the alternative minimum tax on a consolidated basis. They were comparing apples to apples. And significantly, the court, I'll quote in his holding, held that in determining, quote-unquote, taxes imposed, which is a similar term here, you look to the tax imposed on the, quote, consolidated taxable income, close quote, of the affiliated group. And so to look to tax imposed, you look to the consolidated taxable income, which, again, is line 30 of the tax return. And if you look to a separate return basis, it's, again, line 30, taxable income. It would just be separate taxable income. The Sparrow case is similar. The Sparrow case involves income averaging, which is a concept where if you normally earn a certain amount of income year after year, and then you've got this 1 year where there's a big spike for some reason, well, you can average your income over several years to pay a lower tax. So with the different rates in taxes, you would do this. And the individuals here had computed their tax liability using this income averaging concept. And the issue again was an alternative minimum tax. How do you do that? And the tax court in the Sparrow case held apples to apples. You compute both the regular tax and the alternative minimum tax using income averaging. You don't do one with income averaging and the other without. It was just an apples to apples kind of comparison. So I think both cases support us because our position is in computing the South Dakota bank franchise tax, U.S. Bank computes its liability on a separate company basis. It doesn't compute it on a consolidated basis. It's a separate company basis. And therefore, in computing the federal tax deduction, again, you compute it on a separate company basis, comparing apples to apples. And so I think both cases support our position.
I understand your statutory argument. Here's what I'm struggling with factually in this case. As I understand it, and I'm looking at 2011, U.S. Bank Corp., so the consolidated return, they paid total tax liability $617 million. I think I've got the number zeros right. And so that's what they paid in tax, but yet U.S. Bank comes and says, well, we're entitled to a deduction for $819,000. The two don't jive, because my understanding is the franchise tax, what you get is you get a deduction for the taxes imposed. Mm-hmm. Those don't jive with me in terms of factually total tax paid for the entire corporate entity combined is $617 million, but you're asking for a deduction for just U.S. Bank of $819 million. Tell me how you reconcile those numbers.
Certainly, Your Honor. The $617 million that you referenced is the cash payment. If you include the cash payment and the credit payments together, is how you get to the number that we're dealing with. And if you compare, and I don't have the number for 2011 with me right now, but if you would compare the total income, the $617 million, and add to it the credits that the company paid, that total would be the line 30 taxable income number times 30%.
Right, but those credits aren't actual federal tax, U.S. federal tax paid, correct?
Yes, they are, Your Honor. It is our position that it is the payment of the federal tax.
And how would we know that from the record?
The returns show line 30, which is taxable income times the 35% for either U.S. Bank separately or for the consolidated group. And if you look at the consolidated group, which is Schedule J, the Schedule J, line 2, would be that amount, and then it is reduced by both credits and by cash.
But some of those credits are for foreign tax, right?
A small percent were for foreign tax.
But do we know what those numbers are? Can we?
They are on the return.
We have that on the record?
That is on the record, yes, Your Honor.
We have the total credits. We don't have them for U.S. Bank. We have them on the consolidated 1120s, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
We don't have U.S. Bank's portion of that or the general business credits, as I understand it.
That is correct, Your Honor, because the way the returns are computed is you go from line 1 to line 30, line 30 being taxable income, and that's for the consolidated group. And then there's backup called entity detail, which gives the breakout of lines 1 through 30 for all of the members in the consolidated group, including U.S. Bank. And those calculations that you're talking about are after line 30.
I understand, and I can accept on general principles your argument that the case, and there may not be a disagreement with this, the case begins with an examination of the statutory text, more so than maybe getting to incongruity of results or absurdity or relative absurdity of results. I mean, those are things that seem to me to come in after we figure out what the text means. But this is that point that you and I were visiting about earlier, the point at which we have to accept your argument that credits equal cash or cash payment. And though foreign credits aren't a big part of the picture here, it could be in the next case, of course. And if we accept your argument, that's the result that applies not only to U.S. Bank, and I know the law has changed a bit, but that would be the result that would apply to everyone. Correct.
Well, I think that is correct, Your Honor. But I think also that if the department's position is correct, that it is the total tax liability, not the taxable income times the tax rate, then we know what was paid by the consolidated group. You had referenced the number, Your Honor, of the $617 million for the 2011 year. U.S. Bank contributed the majority of the taxable income at issue in each of the years. U.S. Bank had over 87% of the taxable income of the consolidated group in 2012. So if the court were to decide that line 31, Schedule J, line 10 or 11, depending on the year, is the cash payment, then U.S. Bank should at least get its percentage of what was ultimately paid in cash.
Well, I want to talk with you about that, because that's sort of the 2012 issue, right? Because arguably, tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, but as I understand it, the original returns for 2010 and 2011 would contemplate what you just said.
Or, excuse me?
What the original returns, not the amended ones, but the original returns for 2010 and 2011 would contemplate what you just said. Am I correct on that?
I'm not positive of that.
That U.S. Bank was completing their South Dakota Bank franchise tax returns using their percentage, their pro rata, the 87% for 2012, the other percentages for the other years. But they would apply that to the total credits, and then they would take those off of the tax owed, and that's how they would file their returns for 2010 and 2011.
I'm not entirely sure that's correct.
It's a terrible question. I haven't really done a very good job laying it out. Let me. Can I go at it this way? I think you're kind of maybe talking about an alternative position.
That is correct, Your Honor.
That's good. So in the U.S. Bank objection to the auditor's recommendations, the letter from Mr. Scribner had an alternative position. In fact, it was even set out with a heading. You know, at a minimum for 2012, can we take the numerator of our income over the total income, get that percentage, apply it to the tax, and get that? I wasn't so sure that that argument is being made in this appeal. But if I'm wrong, let me know.
Yes, Your Honor. I wouldn't say you're wrong, but we are taking that position.
Okay, is that in the brief?
Yes. It's in the brief, in our reply brief, at page 15, footnote 7. And the argument was raised before the circuit court. It was raised in the protest.
So it comes in the reply brief, and it comes in a footnote. Is that good enough?
I think it is, Your Honor. It raises the issue. It's in the protest, which has gone up. It's been in the briefs throughout. And so, yes, I believe it is sufficient to preserve the issue. And if this court were to rule that line 31 is the tax imposed rather than the line 30 times the tax, then I believe U.S. Bank is entitled to receive that as a deduction for federal taxes.
You would suggest that as your methodology, the alternative methodology, I understand it. Mm-hmm. The numerator, your income over total income, get the percentage and apply that.
Correct. And that would be for the 2012 year, it would be 87%.
Right. Why weren't the administrative decision makers or the circuit court convinced of that? And why weren't they convinced that they had enough information to make that determination when it was in front of them? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't know why the department hasn't given U.S. Bank any deduction at all. It says it doesn't have any information, but it was provided during audit, the federal consolidated income tax returns, the pro forma income tax returns for each of the years at issue, the tax sharing agreement. It had already on file the bank franchise tax original returns for the 3 years, as well as the amended returns. The only thing the department points to that it doesn't have is how U.S. Bank computed its original returns for 2010 and 11, when U.S. Bank filed amended returns and explained how it computed the amended returns. But we believe the Bill of Rights in South Dakota requires the South Dakota Department of Revenue to apply some sort of federal income tax deduction or to explicitly state what exactly it is missing. We believe it has all the information to compute a deduction, and that, going back to your Honor's question earlier about this applying to other taxpayers, how are other taxpayers supposed to know how to compute this deduction? If the department says You file a deduction. If we like it, we'll give it to you. If we don't like it, we won't give it to you, but we'll give you nothing. Shouldn't the state be required to have, if it's enforcing the law, an interpretation of what that law is and how it can be satisfied? Taxpayers shouldn't be required to kind of guess what the Department of Revenue wants it to do. U.S. Bank complies with the law. There was nothing out there describing how to fill out this return, and so it came with a reasonable methodology that we think is supported by the statute and that should be allowed. But the department's response is, oh, we don't like it, therefore we're going to give you nothing. And that can't be the right answer with administration of a tax liability.
Mr. Fields?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not sure if you can hear me.
I can, Your Honor.
Is the difference between your position and the department's position primarily the credits of whether or not you should get credit for, I'm using the word twice here, but credit for the cash and the credits, and they're saying that you shouldn't get different for the credits. I didn't ever see where they really identified how you were to compute the federal tax deduction.
Your Honor, I don't think the department says that. It says line 31 is the proper amount, but it never says that that U.S. Bank is entitled to any deduction at all, despite the fact that it acknowledges that taxes, even under its theory, were paid to the federal government. It never says, therefore, U.S. Bank, you're entitled to a deduction computed this way.
Mr. Fields, your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Director, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. South Dakota imposes an income tax on financial institutions. In order to calculate that tax, we begin with taxable income and then make various statutory modifications. Some additions, some subtractions. In this case, we're dealing with a subtraction, SDCL 1043-10.3 sub 3, which allows a financial institution to deduct federal taxes imposed under the Internal Revenue Code in calculating its bank franchise tax. Now, when we're dealing with a reduction, a deduction, or an exemption, those are all acts of legislative grace, and the burden's on the taxpayer to show they fit squarely within the plain language of that statute. Deduction, reduction, and exemptions are never presumed. And, you know, in this particular instance, you know, it is also worth noting as well that South Dakota is in the minority of states that even allow this deduction. You have Alabama, Louisiana, Missouri, and Illinois. And of those states, two of the four actually only allow a 50% deduction. So this truly is an act of legislative grace.
But we can't use that probably, Mr. Richter. You would agree to guide us in construing the term tax imposed. We've got to start with our statutory rules of construction. If we can read it, we read it. We apply it. If we can't, then we move to some other rules that can help us.
We do.
What are your thoughts on that?
In this case, U.S. Bank's methodology is an error because what we're talking about is taxes imposed on the financial institution. So U.S. Bank wasn't taking a deduction of what was imposed on it or the consolidated group. What it seeks to utilize is a methodology wherein it receives more in excess of what the entire what was imposed on the entire consolidated group. And U.S. Bank bases its methodology on taxable income and multiplying that number by 35%. Well, when we go through and we look facially at the front of the 1120, and this is in the record on page 48, and I'll work off the 2010 return, what we do is we start with income. And, you know, with the 1120, there's 36 lines. You work your way down, much like a 1040. And then there's associated schedules, schedules A through schedule L. And you just, step by step, you just knock them out. And there is no stop. You just keep on going. You follow the directions. And what you do for the 1120 is you start with income. You get to deductions. And then at a certain point, line 30, you arrive at taxable income. There is no stop. There is no wait at that point. Then you go down to line 31. Which says total tax. And it says go look at Schedule J. So you flip a couple pages over, and it's in the record on, you know, on page 50, Schedule J is actually entitled tax computation. And again, Schedule J has multiple steps as well. So you've got 9 steps. You work your way down. Step 2, you take taxable income and multiply that by 35%. But it doesn't say stop at that point. You keep working your way down. You've got your foreign taxes, which we've discussed. You've got your business credits. And you work your way all the way down to line 10. At that point, that is what is actually imposed. And that's consistent with our statutory scheme because we've got SDCL 1043 10.3 sub 3, which allows corporations to deduct federal income taxes imposed. We also have, the state has rulemaking authority under SDCL 1043 42.1, which allows the state to define the deduction for net federal income taxes imposed. So when you take that statutory authority, the state did that. They promulgated a corresponding rule. That rule has the force of law. And when you read the parts of the statutes together, there is, you know, no other language which talks about net federal income taxes imposed. So net means net when you put everything together. So at the end of the day, when the circuit court looked at this, she came to the, Judge Rank came to the conclusion that net actually means net. So we do have that rulemaking authority, and we do have the definition in place.
Well, net means, I mean, is that exactly the case? Debt income, in the case of a financial institution, is taxable income as defined by the Internal Revenue Code. So there's that. I think that's what Mr. Field's saying. So the Internal Revenue Code could, it seems to me, define taxable income as income less deductions. And deductions aren't credits. And so that seems to be the argument. And I think we have to figure out what imposed means as a verb. Is it the application of the tax, or is it instead the compulsion to pay the amount that you calculate, or is it both, or what's your view of that verb and how we ought to read it?
I think the circuit court addressed it pretty well in their opinion. And they talked about imposed in the context of foreign taxes and also the business credits. And essentially, if you look at it, foreign taxes, by their very definition, that credit there, the taxes they pay to another country, certainly are not taxes imposed under the Internal Revenue Code. The circuit court ended up ruling that they're not going to read an absurdity into the statute. And they ended up rejecting the taxable income times 35%.
But before we get to absurdity, we've got to conclude that, I mean, we can't skip to the end. We've got to figure out what imposed means. So what does imposed mean in your view, without regard to whether it's a good result or a bad result in your view? What does imposed mean?
Well, I think the imposed definition is what is actually required to be paid. Yeah. And when you look at it, maybe another thing that this court can look at for illustrative purposes is if you look at page 53 in the record, what it does is it's the work papers for U.S. Banks 1120. And what ends up happening there is it kind of breaks down all the different entities. And at the bottom, it talks about tax and payments. And what it does, first line under tax and payments, total tax, Schedule J. And then they apply overpayments, estimated payments, and then come out with a number. So it's the department's position that that is what is actually imposed. It's consistent with our administrative rule, and when you read everything together, we believe that is the correct result.
Mr. Richter, in the brief for appellant, they contend that the department never did set forth what the rule is on how to calculate the federal deduction. What is the department's position for all, and is it applied the same for all taxpayers, or is it handled by each tax return that's filed?
Well, the department's position in this case is the statutory scheme is clear. It talks about taxes imposed, and when you combine that with our administrative rules, you should be able to figure it out. I mean, it's what's actually required to be paid at the end of the day.
What is your view regarding this alternative method proposed by the appellants as set forth in their footnote 7 in their reply brief.
So footnote 7 in the reply brief, I would at first say that the argument is not preserved, because when you put something in a reply brief at the very end, they haven't preserved the argument. That being said, if we want to get into the argument itself, U.S. Bank has argued that it should be entitled to an alternative method. Well, first, there is no statutory requirement for an auditor to propose an alternative method, for a circuit court judge to propose an alternative method, for a hearing examiner to propose an alternative, or this court to propose an alternative method. The fact is, the burden is on the taxpayer to show that they fit squarely within the plain language of the statute. And they have certain obligations in that duty of trying to prove up their case. For example, under 1043.43.1, the taxpayer has record-keeping requirements. They need to provide all information related to bank franchise. We've got an administrative rule, 64260204, which talks about returns. There's another obligation there. There's also statutory warnings in terms of providing records and evidence under 1059.3 and 1059.7 in relation to a certificate of assessment. In relation to a certificate of assessment, a taxpayer has 60 days to provide all evidence of deduction, reduction, or exemption, or it need not be considered. Likewise, in 1059.21, there's similar record provision requirements in terms of documenting a refund request. All these statutory obligations and warnings went unheeded. U.S. Bank, I think the record reflects and it shows, had the information for the 2010 and 2011 returns. When you go back to their initial brief filed with the Office of Hearing Examiners, U.S. Bank claims that, you know, through testimony, that it utilized its 2012 methodology in 2005, 2006, and 2007. And then in 8, 9, 10, and 11, an error occurred, which we'll talk about a little bit. And then in 2012, they went back to the pre-2008 methodology. So when that testimony was made, I think it evidences that U.S. Bank had in its possession the 2010 and 2011 returns, and when the auditor requested it, those returns in IDR number 2 to substantiate the methodology and how to calculate the tax, U.S. Bank did not provide it. So U.S. Bank had multiple opportunities along the way to provide those 2010 and 2011 methodologies. I mean, obviously, we've got, as I mentioned, the 1043.43.1 requirements, so it should have been provided with the returns. U.S. Bank did not provide that. There was through the audit process. U.S. Bank had another opportunity when the IDR went out before the audit and during the audit, and then you've got 1059.3 and 7. There was a notice of intent which went out. Again, this information was requested and it was not received.
So if I could interrupt you,
yes.
We're talking about this information. And if your argument is they're too late, then I understand your argument. But what specifically about the method, and if it just came too late, then you can tell me that. But what specifically does the department have an objection to, if anything, about this method that they suggested in the original letter from Mr. Scribner that has that set out, and it's kind of captured in footnote 7 of the reply brief, where you compute the percentage that U.S. Bank represented for the entire U.S. Bank Corp group for the taxes that were due, and then you apply that to you apply that pro rata to the credits, and then you add that back to their cash payment, and then you figure out their taxes paid that way. Is that not okay? What's the department's view on that? I'm still trying to figure that out.
So the issue is, when the auditor went in, the only thing that U.S. Bank provided was the taxable income times 35%. And that resulted in that inflated number that we're talking about here. Now, what the auditor observed while he was going through the audit is for that 2010 and 2011 period, as opposed to taking 133 to 175% of what was imposed on the total consolidated group, the amount taken for those years was about 56%. So the auditor thought, that's a little bit more reasonable. I'd like to see the methodology behind that. And, you know, I think there's case law out there. It's mentioned briefly, I believe in Washington Mutual Inc. versus United States. And essentially, kind of the gist of it is, you know, the taxpayer has the burden to prove up the amount. And when records aren't provided, you know, they can't later complain about not receiving the full amount of the deduction. So the auditor did look at it. He thought, well, the methodology does appear correct. And, you know, there is no presumption that when you're filing the 1120 that things are correct. Otherwise, we wouldn't have audits. So the auditor was digging in and said, okay, let's look at 10, let's look at 11, let's look at 12. What is the methodology? What's the breakdown? How did you get to that 56%? Because at this point, U.S. Bank is just taking as gospel that, you know, the 73% is the right number. And we haven't touched on it, but in order to get to that number, I believe they rely on the tax sharing agreement. And the tax sharing agreement's an internal document. So at the end of the day, after the auditor reviewed what he had in his possession, and that's really all he can do is review the facts that were in his possession, he came to the conclusion that he could not substantiate what U.S. Bank's actual methodology or allocation would be.
Not even for the 87% for 2012.
Right.
Okay. Mr. Richter, what specifically is the department saying the bank did wrong? Is it the credits? I've read the whole record and all the briefs, and I can't figure out what your position is.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's taking a number that's too high to begin with, so it's the credits. And then the second part you need to substantiate is the actual breakdown or allocation between entities.
Between
the different entities. So, for example, you've got U.S. Bank Corp, which is the parent company, right? And then U.S. Bank is a piece of that. And then what we're trying to figure out is what piece U.S. Bank actually is. And we need to substantiate that number. And what the auditor asked for were the profit and loss statements. They asked for the legal analysis. And they wanted to know how was it that during 2008, 9, 10, and 11 years, that U.S. Bank was utilizing a methodology that resulted in a 56%. So what this kind of comes down to at the end of the day is when you look at it, U.S. Bank made decisions about providing records, and they made legal and tactical decisions in terms of what they presented. When you go through the briefs from the beginning, it's always the 2012 methodology. They proposed no alternative methodology. And the burden rests with U.S. Bank to propose that methodology and to show that they fit within the plain language of the statute.
Other than that,
so your objection is to the methodology, not to the credits.
Well, the credits are a part of the methodology. U.S. Bank's own witness, Brett Scribner, testified, and you can look in the record that foreign taxes are not taxes imposed. So
if I'm understanding you, you're saying then that the auditor and for that matter, the department was maybe not endorsing the methodology for 2010 and 2011, but it was maybe good enough and they really couldn't go back, as I understand it, and assess more. And so they just kind of left that go.
Yeah, I don't know if endorsing is, they were unable to review the 2010 and 2011 methodology.
The department didn't say, this is good to go.
Yeah, no, they did not say that's
right,
good to go.
That's what right. I thought.
Yep.
And they, although at first blush, it may have seemed reasonable enough, when the audit drilled down, they couldn't make it exactly fit.
Yes.
And that's what you're telling me. And that's why they don't get anything in 2012, because They just didn't give you the information to tell you exactly what it is, and you're not willing to accept the 87% alternative calculation?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, they had every opportunity to provide records. They didn't. I mean, as you look through the briefs, you know, U.S. Bank makes a statement, but the auditor acknowledged U.S. Bank is probably entitled to something. And throughout our brief, I think we said, you know, had they provided records, they could have been entitled to something. The problem is they did not meet their burden. You know, other courts have similarly determined that a claimant's failure to substantiate tax liability prevents that person from later complaining about the taxing authority's decision. And we've got a bunch of different cases on this subject, but Stafford versus Commissioner 47 TCM 172, and essentially in that they say having failed to provide information during the audit, claimant could not be heard to complain on appeal. We've got a South Dakota case, Doctors and Associates, 2006 SD 18, and this is between paragraphs 14 and 22. And essentially the holding in that case is taxpayers proffered evidence, which should have been given during the audit, was properly kept out of hearing. Just to mix things up, I've thrown in a New Jersey Supreme Court case and a Missouri Supreme Court case, Ocean Pines Limited versus Borough of Point Pleasant, 547 A2D 691. The appeal is limited to decision based upon information available to assessor, and taxpayer's failure to provide information precluded introduction on appeal. And then you've got a Missouri Supreme Court case, Kansas City Royals, 32 SW3D 560. Director could not make meaningful determination on refund claim without specific information. Now, in this particular instance, in terms of the method, alternative methodology, you know, as I pointed out previously, there is no statutory requirement that the auditor present a methodology. The burden rests squarely on U.S. Bank to provide that methodology. They made conscious decisions not to provide that information during the audit. There were legal and tactical decisions made not to present information on appeal. The alternative methodology was not preserved. And when I'm talking about on appeal, what I'd very quickly cite to is U.S. Bank attempted to introduce Exhibit 17. So it introduced something in support of its 2012 methodology, but at the end of the day, it did not introduce the 2010 and 2011. U.S. Bank had the keys to unlock the exemption. They chose not to provide them. That's why the certificate of assessment, we'd ask that the department would ask that the certificate of assessment be affirmed and the denial of the refunds be upheld.
Thank you, Mr. Richter. Mr. Fields, you may proceed with rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. The department says line 31 is tax imposed. It never cites any authority as to why that should be the tax imposed under the Internal Revenue Code. U.S. Bank says it's line 30. We cite to the Internal Revenue Code, section 11, which says tax imposed on taxable income. So we do have authority, and the department cites to no authority. U.S. Bank is not asking the department to propose an alternative method. U.S. Bank has asked the department to provide its regular method for auditing companies. What does it believe the correct computation is? And it has never provided that. All it says is, oh, you didn't tell us how you computed the returns, which you subsequently amended and filed refund claims on because you thought they were inaccurate. You didn't tell us how you did that. Therefore, we can't give you any deduction at all.
If their position is, though, as it seems, and was early on, that taxes imposed means what you paid, your tax liability, or for an accrual method, you know, what you paid or what you're liable for accrual method taxpayers, then that, if that's their, right or wrong, if that's the way they're construing that text, then doesn't U.S. Bank know what it needs to do in order to get the deduction? You need to tell them what you paid or what you're liable for taxes.
I believe they have all that information from the consolidated return, from the pro forma returns. Mr. Richter mentioned the profit loss statements. I believe those are in the tax returns.
But even under your footnote 7, you suggest, as I understand my discussion with Mr. Richter, I may be wrong, but he seems to be saying, look, that wasn't satisfying for the department or for the auditors. Though the rough and ready, my words, and his calculation of the numerator over the denominator and using the pro rata may not have flagged anything in 2010 and 2011. Once they got to the audit and they were drilling down deeper, they couldn't, they were looking for more precise information, it seems like, in terms of what U.S. Bank paid. And as I look at the entire record or in the briefs as well, I come away with the sense that I don't know what U.S. Bank paid. I know that there's a percentage that you're suggesting is way at the end of the briefs that should be applied, but I mean, I don't know what that number is. Is there somewhere in the record where I can look and you can say, U.S. Bank paid this number or was liable for this number in 2012?
Well, we believe it was the line 30 times the tax return and those numbers times the tax rate. And those numbers are in the record, yes, Your Honor. If you're asking if there is a line 31 for U.S. Bank individually, the answer is no. That's not required to be computed, nor has it ever. Or was it computed?
Is it an appellate error? Or is it the obligation of the courts to ensure that you know what the methodology is? Or is that rather something that should be left to the administrative body to promulgate regulations and perhaps provide greater clarity? Is that the obligation of the courts, the circuit court, or this court to tell you or to prescribe some methodology by which you can calculate your deduction?
Not by which a particular taxpayer can, but by all taxpayers can, yes, Your Honor. I think the auditor in testimony in the administrative record, page 382, lines 11 through 13, testified he had no method. He had absolutely no method. How could the department not have a method and yet audit taxpayers? Do they have different standards and different methodologies for each taxpayer? That can't be the way the taxes are enforced. The Bill of Rights says it's supposed to be a uniform, equal process for taxpayers. So, yes, I think the court can require the department to have a methodology, to articulate a methodology. We think we fit within the methodology that we used. We have never heard any other methodology to use. We're just told, well, you didn't tell us how you computed it for 2010 and 11, therefore you're not entitled to anything. Those are the only two choices the department had. We believe the department had a third choice. It could have told us what the method is it uses for every other taxpayer. How do all the other taxpayers, there's lots of banks that are filed tax returns here. They're all, most, if not all, file as part of consolidated returns. They must be taking a deduction. The department must be auditing them. How can there not be the methodology that the department has?
Don't you think the answer to that question is the total amount of tax that you're liable for and that you got to pay? And that doesn't, it seems to me that that's pretty clearly, again, right or wrong, it seems clear that's what they're saying.
But they don't say that. And we believe that that is the line 30 times the tax.
Well, that's the appeal, I guess. But
but that is the amount that U.S. Bank is subjected to tax. Taxable income times the 35%. That is the amount it owes. It pays it with both credits and with cash payments. And U.S. Bank is not saying foreign tax credits are taxes imposed. They're not saying the tax share agreement is taxes imposed. They're not saying the estimated payments are taxes imposed. They are the way the taxes imposed are satisfied or reduced. It's not a tax imposed. It is the payment of those taxes that were imposed. Mr. Richter mentioned the record-keeping requirements, and those are factual in nature. They're not legal. The legal issue is what is the methodology and how to determine it. Whether or not records were provided or not, we believe all the records were provided, but even if they were not, state should still have, the department should still have a methodology and use that methodology. You mentioned earlier that the amount paid, when you look to the deduction taken exceeds the amount paid. But that's only if you look to line 31, not if you look to line 30. If you look to line 30, then the deduction is always less than the consolidated group's tax liability. The answer to your question earlier, Your Honor, you'd asked about credits and the total amount for 2011. The taxes paid in cash were $617 million, in credits $631 million, for a total of $1,248
million. For 2011?
For 2011, yes.
Yeah, and you would just say take your percentage of that, which is the way it wound up going, because for 2011.
Right. The department's rule, it says net federal income tax. And what it says is that that's the federal income tax in excess of the federal income tax refund. There's no refunds at issue here. And there is no methodology in these regulations. It just says whatever you paid is deductible. How do you determine what that is? We think we know. We think it's line 30 times the tax rate, but there's nothing else. There's no mechanism designed for this. Mr. Richter also mentioned that there was nothing in the returns as filed as to how the federal tax deduction was computed. That's because there's no requirement in their tax returns to provide that information. It's just a line on the return. There is no place to put a rider. There is no additional place to put that information. So U.S. Bank shouldn't be penalized for not doing something that's not required on the return. Well, if there are no further questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Richter. The case is now submitted, and we will be in recess for 10 minutes.